This is Sport Matters with Kenneth Shropshire and Bill Roden. From academia to media, Ken and Bill explore the edges of sport, unpacking race and culture beyond the game.
Welcome to the Sport Matters podcast. I'm Ken Shropshire, and I'm here with my friend, colleague, associate, the great writer, columnist, author, an all-around good guy, Bill.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good now. Better to hear that. That's always a good way to start the day.
Somebody's saying something good about you. Somewhere.
Oh, man. We could have that every day. Somebody say one good thing about you. That's great. How are you doing?
Good. I'm ready to talk about these topics. We tried to narrow down with so much of the world things that we thought would be of interest, and that the two old guys might have something to add to the public conversation. So we're going to talk a little bit about this being the fifth anniversary of Colin Kaepernick kneeling. We're going to talk about this. What's got a conversation going there by this Netflix event, Malice in the Palace. So we're going to kind of look back on that and see if the great Bill Roden was there and what his thoughts were about it, and kind of compare it to today. And then finally, we'll look at J.R. Smith going back to college to North Carolina A&T and what that means. So Bill, 5 years later, Colin Kaepernick, I think we can say, can we say with certainty he's not going to play in the National Football League again?
I think that ship has sailed.
That ship has sailed.
Yeah.
What are we making 5 years later? What mission accomplished? I guess that might be the question.
Well, I guess it depends on what the mission is. You know, it was so intense when it happened. Was there some type of long term? I think the most poignant long term effect was that he's not playing football anymore, and it probably discouraged any further dissent. I think a lot of players learned their lesson. And then I guess, I don't know how you feel, I guess it's sort of what's the direction? You know, the question always was, you know, where do we go from here? In the words of Jay-Z, the immortal words of Jay-Z, we're beyond kneeling. And the question is, that's probably true, but then what? You know, what's sort of the next thing, the next level, you know? So 5 years later, Kaepernick is not playing football. I think he still has his Nike deal. I'd say that he's still somewhat iconic, right? I mean, I think he will always be associated with player protest,
right?
Except there is no more player protest, pretty much. That movement.
And you say that because protests are now allowed. There's permission given to do 99% of everything these players, even during the Olympics. I mean, it's the, you know, rules have changed to allow some version of protest to take place. So that's, by definition, at least I've been saying, is no longer protest.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. And I guess to some extent, what he did is set the tone for player empowerment. You know, because of what he did, the reaction to what he did, him being blackballed. I think, you know, you look at him, Naomi Osaka, even Simone Biles. I think that he sort of set the tone for players to step out of the little box and, you know, speak their minds, protest. You know, the WNBA players took up his mantle and became, they took his protest to another level. So I guess it probably wouldn't be fair to say nothing changed. I think players' view of their own power changed. But what does that mean exactly? How is that going to play out? I'm not sure. But he did have an impact, I'd say, probably a long-lasting impact, of players, you know, players seeing their own strength. Now, you mentioned being allowed to play. I think the NFL is still pretty much a prison. I don't think there's a whole lot of leeway there. I mean, I think George Floyd probably had a bigger impact in terms of hirings and things like that.
It was almost the George Floyd moment, because we've talked about a lot, was almost an accelerant of, you know, if that was 4 years in for the first day of kneeling for Kaepernick, that really lifted it back up and redirected it too. And some ways, as you're saying, to these broader issues, to don't just look externally at police brutality, but also look internally at the league itself. So right. That did set the league, you know, how many steps further out, you know, we don't know. Then it was still not the greatest hiring season, but
yeah, right.
More effort, I guess, is the way to look at it in terms of what the league appeared to be trying to do with regard to those issues. I guess, you know, related, we were talking about this as we were coming on, recording this on Tuesday, Cam Newton's released, great quarterback, hard to find anybody else with the basic skills and physical traits that he has. You know, still a relatively young man. Any connection with that and Kaepernick, or did Kaepernick have any impact on this particular release, or any kind of player transactions?
Just jokingly, we said that it was like an eye for an eye. The Patriots said on the fifth anniversary of Kaepernick, we're going to cut a black quarterback.
Right.
Although, if I can remember, Cam was, if I can remember correctly, he was a little neutral on that. I think he didn't really have anything strong to say. In fact, I think if we go back in the archives, I think he was very neutral on Kaepernick. Because I think he even took some heat for it.
For not stepping up and saying more and then continue to come to, you know, post-game with his dandy outfits on and that sort of thing.
Yeah, right. He almost went to the other extreme. You know, curious to see what he says now that he got cut.
All right, so we cannot draw a straight line. Although, right. So what could happen is, see, this is another instance, and then make the direct connection. But it will be interesting if he doesn't get picked up right away, if people will make more of that connection. He is another black man, and then you have again, just that he's been in the league for a long time and he's a kind of a workman kind of quarterback. You know, Fitzpatrick is the starting quarterback for the Washington football team now. So,
right.
You know, that's the 19-year journeyman is still there where, you know, for sure, again, I'm way over my line trying to talk about football acumen. But, you know, to have a Kaepernick or to have a Newton on your team, I don't know. It just strikes me that there's a little talent differential there. And you look to the one difference. I guess Fitzpatrick has a Harvard degree and they don't. Is that it?
Maybe. That could be it. but I think that you make a good point when you bring up, because I was really maybe we talked a couple of weeks ago, this really seemed to be a great season for black quarterbacks. You know, all the number of quarterbacks who are going to start or in neck and neck competition, you know, whether it's the rookie quarterbacks, you know, Justin Fields, if you look around the league. So I said, wow, we're really kind of breaking through.
Right.
But I think that the whole, to your point, the black quarterback thing is still a thing. You know, it's not, I think that, you know, whenever we start looking at all the black quarterbacks, you could always see there's going to be backlash.
Right.
You know, when we talk about the explosion and the rise of black quarterback, then you see the Matt Joneses and people pushing the Trevor Lawrences and all that. But, you know, so I do think that even the thing with Cam, and I'm listening to the local, the local radio people talk about it. And I still think this whole black quarterback rise is still a thing. You know, I mean, that's still the last preserve of sort of white male, whatever you want to call this stuff that's going around. And I think that there are people who thought they were getting ready to lose control of it. And now you've got Matt Jones, look like Garoppolo's trying to hold off, you know, the kid in San Francisco. So, again, you're right. It'll be interesting to see. It'll be instructive to see if somebody picks up Newton.
Right.
You know, any league that could accommodate Ryan Fitzpatrick, you're right. There's got to be room for Cam Newton.
Not that there's anything wrong with him. It's a good man to have on your roster. He does come in and brings, what do they say, Fitz magic. So
eventually, as everybody says, he's going to burn your house down. You know, he's the kind of guy who will go and build a nice, really garden for you, really nice garden, nice garden gate. They don't go and kick it down, you know. I think that there's probably more. We're looking for connections and fans. I think that was a big thing about Kaepernick, is that it really demonstrated the strained relationship between this predominantly white in-stadium fan base and rising number of young black players. I think, you know, if you look at the reaction that Kaepernick triggered, It was really made this largely white, you know, in-stadium fan base feel very uncomfortable. And to me, that was a big eye-opener. That was a big divide. And the Malice in the Palace was probably a precursor to that, you know.
So let's talk about the Malice in the Palace. I think you're right. Both in terms of burning the house down and this whole idea of who are the fans. And you said you haven't had a chance to watch the Netflix version of this, which actually, you know, my momentary role as a critic here was actually, you know, pretty good pandemic watching in terms of a historic event happened in 2004. This was when for those, and I guess many people that was in their youth.
Right.
And, Ron Artest. Was accosted by a fan in terms of having a cup thrown at him from the stands. And he went into the stands to get this fan, ended up getting the wrong fan, and a huge melee broke out. So this piece, Malice in the Palace, recounts all the events leading up to this, talks about what was going on in the game at the moment that Artest had just fouled Ben Wallace and a little scuffle, and Artest ended up laying on a training table.
Right.
Got the five, trying to you know, catch his breath. And he had a reputation as somebody who would go wild himself. So he was actually doing a lot of the right stuff. Also, I mean, interesting in this too, I mean, when you get a chance to watch it, Jermaine O'Neal, kind of his role in the whole thing, on his viewpoint, which was one that I don't think many of us heard. But to your point, the fan that threw the cup, John Green, white man, most of the fans that you saw in this whole context were white players. And as a sidebar, there's another little documentary going on. If you listen to the podcast of The King of Crenshaw, have you heard this?
Oh, yeah. One of our guys at the Undefeated hosted that, Justin Tinsley.
Yeah. And it's talking about the NBA players' relationships with Nipsey Hussle, the late Nipsey Hussle of Crenshaw and Slauson fame in L.A. And I think about that because they one of the things that Justin highlights is that the coming out moment for the world to kind of Nipsey Hussle was at, I think it was the Lakers-Houston game. And in that game, I forget why the fight broke out. Nipsey's near the floor, not yet this famous guy. And the fight breaks out. And you can see in the video, Nipsey stands up and pulls his pants up. You know, it's kind of the gang move when you get ready to fight. So he pulls his up, which is kind of the, I guess, more of the street reaction. If something breaks out, you're just getting ready as opposed to, you know, Black fans getting involved in a rumble like the Malice of the Palace. That's not traditionally the kind of thing you see. But then this Nipsey Hussle is, but I'm ready to rumble was kind of the role that he was playing. And he said, there's a I hadn't heard much recorded by him other than his performances, but he said, what do you think? I'm going to get in a fight with some NBA players. Was kind of I'm just ready to defend myself. But these fans, you know, this 2004 event, Malice at the Palace, it really is striking to see that. And a couple of months ago, I guess you and I were talking about the name of the episode, the Sport Matters episode that we did was Fans Gone Wild. And we were talking about how fans were doing this. I guess, you know, how much has it all changed since 2004? Or has it? I mean, what do you remember about 2004?
Yeah, I remember the, again, like the Kaepernick thing. It was so huge at the moment. And now you kind of struggle to remember what actually happened, you know? Right. But it was such a huge socioeconomic thing. In fact, I think David Leonard wrote a book about it. And it was talking about this divide between, you know, Black fans and Black players, which I think we saw last NBA season, same thing, you know, with Russell Westbrook. There are a few incidences, probably in the past 3 or 4 years, there have been incidents of these white fans confronting Black players.
Right.
I think for a minute, I thought that when the pandemic unplugged all this stuff, you know, I thought that, and you heard all the fans bemoaning their fate. Oh, we can't go to the stadiums. And this disconnection. And players talking about how much they missed them. And then as soon as fans were allowed back in the stadiums, you saw the same stuff going on. You know, dumping beer on Westbrook.
Right.
Spitting on the kid from Atlanta. You know, so I think there's this tension between white fans and Black players that kind of is the undertone is the tension between Black and white people in society in the United States. And that's played out in these sports arenas where these white fans, and they probably no Black folks in their circles at all. This is, you know, probably the time they have the most contact with Black players and in these arenas. So all this racist stuff could just kind of pour out, you know. I don't think that's changed. And I think the Malice in the Palace exacerbated it. You know, and Kaepernick, I think, exacerbated it too, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm trying to think of the timeline of things happening. And, you know, earlier, if I'm not mistaken, was Latrell Sprewell getting his arms around the neck of, or hands around the neck of PJ Carlissimo, his coach at the time. That was problematic. That was a kind of Black encounter. And then just the whole, you know, the other kind of big race moment. Again, around that time, a little bit earlier than the Malice in the Palace, but overlapping was just the whole Allen Iverson AI experience and the constant references to his cornrows, to his posse, that he was really just this outlier in terms of what the NBA was all about. And the constant piece of that moment, if you think about it, and the big difference of today, if we're going to find a difference, was David Stern's actions to try to control it. That comes out in the docuseries too. Is Stern was basically no nonsense I guess he suspended Artest for the entire season, and Jermaine O'Neal was, you know, some long period of time as well, and others. And, you know, just comparing Stern with Adam Silver and the way Silver, you know, not always right, but definitely not imposing dress codes and kind of the whole, no, we want to whiten this thing up, you know?
Exactly.
It's interesting to think about the, you know, the ABA merger into the NBA and the, you know, kind of the blackification of the NBA in some ways by bringing that in. And, you know, and the number of players, Jeff, I forget where I was just reading that recently, the number of players to talk about their time in the ABA, the Old American Basketball Association, was some of the best times of their basketball life, was better than the NBA in that sense, where culture was allowed and celebrated. And they knew they had to differentiate their brand. And now the NBA, I think, has found, as so much of society has, ways to co-opt the pieces that they can commercialize, as opposed to completely, you know, shunning them and saying, no, that we can't have any of this. This is, you know, we're set shots and three dribbles and pass kind of league. I mean, right. They allowed so much more to go forward.
I love the ABA, you know, it was kind of like the AFL.
Right.
Which had much more black culture in it. I just don't think that gap has really, that I don't think that's changed. I don't think that tension has really changed.
Right.
For better or for worse. I want to talk about Stern. And, you know, Stern's thing was how to take this blackening league and somehow whiten it to the extent that fans would look at all these black players, but they wouldn't see blackness. I think that was for Stern the beauty of Michael Jordan. You know, you could take this brown-skinned black man, but he was so neutral that, you know, it was palatable. I think he almost saw the league like that we could have all these black stars, but not let you see their blackness. I think that's the palace basically broke all that down, because you saw blackness in spades. You know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we'll talk about it after you get a chance to watch it. But I think they didn't say it overtly, but you became, if you weren't already, much more sympathetic to the black players that were actually prosecuted legally. As a result of their involvement in this, and you know, the white men who got off as a result, and the whole language of, you know, how dare them come into the stands, into our domain,
into our space.
Yeah, I remember that was a big piece of it too. So yeah,
we could invade theirs, but it's like going to the zoo. You know, it's like the zoo. You can go to the zoo and throw peanuts at the bears and all that, and then somebody leaves the door open. You know, you find, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're with this tiger. Say, I've been waiting for your ass, you know. Yeah, you know.
All right, for everybody keeping score, Bill has gone to the I think the prison analogy came up today, and the zoo analogy. We have not done the plantation today, but I'm sure we may have a chance for that one to come up.
Give us time. We still got JR.
Well, yeah, let's close out with what I think. I don't know. I'm talking to you. You never know how this is going to end up. I think it's a feel-good story. I mean, here's a player, a former player, former NBA player, now 35 years old, played in the NBA 16 years. By some accounts, I can't tell if he made or has in the bank $35 million. So he's in good shape by any measure, unless you compare it to Bezos or Zuckerman or Zuckerberg or somebody
like Bill Gates, right?
Yeah, Gates, right. So
Bill Gates would wake up with $35 million in his account, he'd probably jump off a building. He said, where did I go wrong?
So Smith decides to go back to college not to his, we think he went to North Carolina, but he ends up going back to college in North Carolina A&T to get his degree, I think a degree, seeking a degree in liberal studies. And he's been tweeting about his progress in the first week. So we've been witnessing this the past week. What are your thoughts about JR going back to college?
My thought that, you know, he's about 16 years too late. If I'm A&T, he said, where were you when we needed you? You know, when we really needed you to come to A&T, you went to UNC. You know, it's kind of like all these guys, man, like Deion and Eddie George, bless his heart. You know, they're all now finding religion in HBCUs. You know, HBCUs are giving them chances that that their alma maters would not give them. You know?
All y'all
who go to PWI.
You know when CBS on the morning show, they do, they're bringing an author or something like that, and they say, and CBS is partially owned by Random House. They disclose kind of their relationships. I think we need to disclose your HBCU. I didn't know we'd go in this direction. See, I knew we couldn't just have a pure feel-good story. So,
I let it feel good. I mean, it felt good. I'm just saying, you asked me my initial response. It was like 16 years, a little late. A little late, you come back. You know, where were you when we needed you? Same thing with Deion. You know, Deion, not Coach Jazz. Deion, how come you couldn't have done that, you know, when you were coming out of high school? Eddie, why did you come out? You know, I was speaking to, you know this brother too, man, the president of the G League, Sharif.
Yeah, Sharif Abdul-Rahim, yeah, yeah.
I was talking to him at the NBA draft, and he was talking about, you know, his relationship with you guys, and I immediately tried to, like, steer him. I said, well, you know, that'd be great to establish the same type of relationship with an HBCU. And the conversation... You know, he said he went back to Cal Berkeley to get his degree. Right. But he said, I could have gone anywhere to get my degree, you know. And what he was just saying how you could have these relationships with HBCUs, and these guys, you can go to an HBCU. It's not going to hurt you, you know, if you get your finish up at Howard or finish it up at Morgan. And I think it's the same thing with playing. I had a dinner with J.R. Reed a couple days ago. And, you know, he was a big deal coming out of high school.
Right.
And he went to North Carolina. And I asked him, I said, man, don't you think that you could have gone to the league anywhere you went? You could have gone to NCCU. Don't you think you could have made it? And he said, yeah. Given my skill and talent, probably could have, you know. So, yes, JR is a feel-good story, but he could have done this. I wish he would have done this 16 years ago. Is that, you think that's unrealistic?
you know, it's, so this is going to be an interesting year for HBCUs in a number of ways. And this is not where I thought the segment was going, but let's keep going down this road a little bit. You know, first of all, with the increasing number, I'll say, of young Black players, nothing to write home about, coming out of high school that are going to HBCUs that pass on going to the PWIs. I mean, that's one. We'll see how that turns out. That's a real movement. But the second is, and you alluded to them almost negatively, but the idea of Eddie George at Tennessee State and Deion Sanders at Jackson State, right? They're you know, great NFL stars, and now they are head coaches at these HBCUs. I've got you over where they could have gone in the first place. Now let's go beyond that. Is this overall a good thing?
I think it's great. I mean, it brings attention to HBCUs, which is good. You know, I told you before the show started, I'm doing this HBCU road tour on an RV, kind of like the Black equivalent of Peyton Places, you know. And one of the stops we're going to make is in Jacksonville to this young kid, Micaiah Pollard, whose father played in the NFL for about 8 or 9 years. And his son is probably pretty soon going to announce that he's going to Michigan. And I said, I asked the dad, you know, could he have gone to an HBCU? And he said, well, that probably was not realistic. And I get that too. I mean, you know, so yes, I think it's great, but do I think it's realistic to expect these top tier players to go to HBCUs? I mean, I honestly, you know, I went to Morgan State and I went there, you know, I keep thinking if I would have been better, if I would have been any more valuable, if the white man would have said, this boy got value, we want him. But, you know, realistically, if I would have been heavily recruited and, you know, would have gone to, you know, been recruited by University of Michigan, Illinois, and another school made my visits. And then my last visit was to Morgan. You know, realistically, you know, you would have probably had to be really at a philosophic and political bent to say, no, this goes beyond brick and mortar. This is not about brick and mortar. This is about philosophy and investing in Black institutions. If you didn't have that kind of mindset, which most 18-year-olds do not, you know, it's not fair to suggest. I mean, you went to Stanford, you know, beautiful campus, hell of a program. You know, what would have taken for you to say, no, I'm gonna go across country and go to Howard or something like that? I mean, right. would that be realistic to expect?
Yeah, I'm a double layer. Not to try to make alibis for myself. I'm happy with what I did, but to leave California to go to an HBCU was, you know, the HBCU, you know, this didn't exist. You know, you had to go all the way to, I guess, Texas Southern was the closest, or Langston, right. Which, you know, I don't have my geography straight, but it wasn't right around the corner. You had to go over a few states to get there. And I was recruited by Howard. So they were on my list, and my parents had gone to HBCUs. So I had an awareness. And you're right. I mean, right or wrong, Stanford just got the Rose Bowl, and kind of, you know, in my mind, you know, my really illogical thing that I'm going to play in the NFL. This is where I need to go. Is to the school that's just gone to the Rose Bowl. So yes, it wasn't a real consideration. But as you said, it was kind of, you know, frankly, it was a fallback consideration at that time. And you know, to do things over again, to think of, I would have played presumably a lot more, had more opportunities, different, you know, there are a lot of things that could have been different, but that's, give me 10 more years of life before I can really start reflecting back that far, trying to think about what I should have done. So let's close this out though. I mean,
but to close out, yes, I think JR playing golf at A&T was great. It's a feel good story, but a little late.
All right. Well, I know how to end on an up note when you get one from the great Bill Ruins. Let's take that. Bill, any closing thoughts on any of the topics or anything else that's gone on this week?
I think great conversation. In fact, until our great producer sent those things, I didn't realize that we had all those anniversaries coming up. Kaepernick seemed like it was just yesterday. I didn't realize it was, right. What, 5 years. The Mouse, the Palace, was it 17 years?
Yeah.
You know, but it, to me, it's just how, if you look at how we reacted in that moment, and today it's almost like, you know, I can't almost remember what it was like in that moment, how intense it was, because there have been so many other things, you know. But I think of all those three things, I think they all speak to the relationship between white fans and Black players.
Yeah.
That underlying tension. I think even with Cam Newton getting cut and the job going to Alabama, you know, Alabama's Matt Jones, you know, I think even that speaks to this underlying backlash of all these young Black quarterbacks taking over, because again, that's the last preserve, you know. I'll be very curious to see how this turns out. Will somebody pick him up? You know, will somebody pick up Cam? And even your guy, Kyler Murray, you know, I'm just curious to see how all this stuff plays out, you know.
And then tie it all together with J.R. Smith going back to a black institution, kind of the, you know, in some ways, it's a place where you confront a lot of issues, but these kinds of issues that we're talking about in terms of the broad malice of the palace issue and Kaepernick, what he's had to endure, that's part of the beauty, at least in the tradition of HBCUs, is not to have to encounter that, but to be able to do the work that you need to do to get the degree and move forward and learn to grow without that one element of society, that level of racism hitting you every day as you walk in the classroom.
So did J.R. not graduate from North Carolina? Is that the story? He's getting his degree?
It's an undergrad degree, so I assume not. Yeah, undergrad degree in liberal studies.
Wow. So he got to go back to a black college, get that too, after the Tar Heels squeezed all the basketball out of him. He didn't get the one thing that is valued to UNC, which is their degree. So he got to go to A&T to get his degree.
We almost got off with a positive, but that's okay.
It's positive he's going to get his degree. Good for him. Goody, goody.
Bill, thanks for spending time today on the Sport Matters podcast. We'll talk again soon.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
This show is brought to you by Global Sport Matters. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen. Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. This episode was produced by me, Kendall Jones, Manager of Events and Programs, and big thanks to sound designer and editor Sam Esparza and Big U Music. Our Marketing and Communications Manager is Crisal Valencia. Our Digital Communications Specialist is Brendan Kleen. And our Marketing and Event Assistants are Natalie Skegan, Aiden Corrales, and Kate Nelson. Stay up to date with the Global Sport Matters team by following us on Twitter. We're at Global Sport MTRS. And be sure to sign up for our newsletter by clicking on the envelope icon at globalsportmatters.com.